You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
This is part two of Think Like a Nobel Prize Winner. Both part one and part two are available today. You can download both of them. In this one, we talk a little bit more about what it means to be as curious as a Nobel Prize winner. How do they get that curious? How can we be that curious? How can I be that curious? Enjoy. Why talk to the Allied Moving Company guy and make and I was specifically talking to him because I was making not only a life decision, but an investment decision because of it. And I imagine part of being curious is finding a tool set that gives you an unfair advantage. So for instance, most people make investment decisions based on the same ideas that are in all the books, that are in the newspapers and so on. But how many people will make a real estate decision by looking at where a moving company driver says he's suddenly seeing a huge amount of people moving from this city to this city, you know, what? And in one city, they make a lot more than the people in the other city. So you know prices are going to then go up. And I imagine for physicists, they're not just all looking at the same. Probably every one of these Nobel Prize winners has figured out kind of a toolkit they can use that gives them an unfair advantage. And I was curious if you found that to be true.
Yeah, I definitely did. And, you know, I think some of the commonality that I observed is directly related to that. And their kind of lack of ego. I wonder sometimes, again, if it's causative or it's part of their DNA or what have you, that you know, the types of people that can listen to you, they're critics. Like, it's one thing to be heckled at a comedy store as, you know, you don't have any experience with that. But you know, if you're heckled at, you know, Stand Up New York, it's different. Like, listening to your critics, like, I get all these comments on my YouTube channel, you know, 99% are positive. Some are like, you know, what the hell are you doing? You're a fraud for like, you know, b- big physics or like, or they'll just make up stuff like, ah, could you have on this guy or that? And just like make it up and call them names and ad hominem attack and then just leave. And I'm like, why am I like even thinking about these people? It's just totally pointless. And I wish I could get, but we also like the accolades. So how do they balance the kind of the benefits of listening to your critics, which is another form of ignoring like the sunk cost. The guy's now telling you, or gal's now telling you're wrong. Like, this isn't the way to look for the cosmic microwave background signal. And you guys got it all wrong. You should listen to us. Maybe they're crackpots, or maybe they're actually very astute, but well, they're certainly in competition with you. Cause as you said, there's fixed resources. There's only so many students that you can hire. There's only so many publications. You have to go through peer review and get, so all these hurdles and obstacles are in the way in these academic hunger games, as I call it. And yet sometimes if you don't listen to them, you know, it is to your detriment. I always say science is an infinite game. In other words, like nobody's going to win science. Like, I can't win science. You can't win science. So we're not in a zero sum competition, but it's comprised of an infinite number of zero sum games, like Nobel Prizes and tenure and funding and graduate students and papers published, et cetera, et cetera. So it's unusual to have, like, sometimes you have to, you know, listen to your critic, who is a competitor to you for resources, et cetera, in the zero sum stage of the infinite game. And sometimes you have to listen to them, you know, because they actually have the right solution to at least making progress against the infinite amount of ignorance that we human beings will always have, no matter how much we learn.
It's a blessing, actually, to have critics, because if the critics are wrong, you've inspired some kind of visceral feeling in them that even though they're wrong, they feel the need to criticize you, whether it's positive, constructive criticism or destructive criticism. Second, and I find this to often be true, they're probably right in their criticism. Like, not all criticism is wrong. Even if it's destructive, by the way. People say, oh, it should be always constructive. Sometimes you have to kind of translate destructive criticism into something useful because they might be right. And the ability to use that as a tool, I think, is another component of the DNA of curiosity. Because like for instance, I'm not comparing myself to physicists, but like when I wrote the article in New York City's Dead Forever, I had a lot of critics. And by the way, I thought most of these critics were wrong. But then I had to ask myself, why am I getting so much criticism? This is more criticism than I've gotten for any other article ever. And why is this happening? And that in itself became a useful exercise to understand what was going on in my writing that I didn't do other times, or what made this article go viral? Why did people, whether they were correct or incorrect, why were there critics at all? And that became, just thinking in that way, you always have to go, like, it seems like going meta and asking kind of abstract questions about what's happening in general, not fighting the critics, but asking why are there critics? Like, why does this situation exist as opposed to resolving the situation? So it's like the second derivative of the situation.
Yeah, that's right. And we had to throw in some equations.
I think that's an important DNA component of curiosity as well.
Well, one of the things that just keeps resonating, again, a book about physics Nobel Prize winners, if you just picked it up, would you think that they mastered some of the skills that you talk about and Skip the Line and Choose Yourself, namely the soft skills, persuasion?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you would. But I think it was very surprising to people when I talked about, like, why do I listen to a bunch of nerds? And why physicists, by the way? Why not, as you said, I mean, look, if you win the Nobel Prize in chemistry, like Jennifer Doudna, are you less, you know, kind of savvy or less physically knowledgeable than somebody who discovered the lighthouse or invented the lighthouse? Which, by the way, when you have imposter syndrome over Einstein, do you have like kind of arrogance about Gustave Dalen, who won the 1908 Nobel Prize instead
Absolutely.
Of Albert Einstein?
Absolutely, he was an
idiot. Yeah, he was a freaking schmuck.
I mean, probably everything he's done has been disproven by now anyway.
Well,
by the way,
it's just
like T.S. Eliot's quote. You said all it does is buy
a ticket to your funeral.
Yeah, like I guess more people go to your funeral if you have a Nobel Prize at this point. So, you know, there's a story. Groucho Marx, T.S. Eliot was obsessed with Groucho Marx, and they met once or twice, I think, and Groucho Marx went to T.S. Eliot's funeral, and he comes back to L.A., and all his friends are, you know, like, you know, George Burns. They're all these, you know, older Jewish comedians and comics and stuff like that. They all said to Groucho Marx, how could you go to T.S. Eliot's funeral? He hated Jews. He was a bad guy. He hated right. Jews and everything. And Groucho Marx said, that's okay. There's a lot of Jews I don't like also.
All right, that's right. And like one of the Simpsons again, you know, Homer Simpson says to Bart, you know, like, or says to somebody, like one of his friends, Carl or something, he's like, you know, I'll be there for your funeral, man. And then Carl says to him, I'll be there for yours too. And it's like, no, it's not going to happen. And they're like, you can't both be at each other's funeral. It's not going to, unless you die in the same day.
That's funny. By the way,
this notion of,
it took me a few seconds to get that one. So that's how, that's 50.
I can't tell if it's like turning 50 or COVID or whatever, but the point, you know, I think is a very crucial one, that these guys have skills that transcend. I mean, some of them, not all of them, but most of them have these skills that it isn't surprising, although to the layperson it might seem surprising. But physicists have this very diverse of curiosity that we have to, you know, often science, all the sciences are depicted as kind of a tree. And the tree has a trunk, a very strong, solid trunk that's physics, because from physics you can derive all the laws of, it said, chemistry. And then from chemistry, you can get the laws of biology. From biology, you can get the laws of evolution, then cognition, and then sociology. And eventually it's, you know, it's Ghanaian poetry in the 16th century. You know, so, but it all starts with physics. But what is physics? The tree planted in math and philosophy, et cetera, and logic. And so I think that these, you know, it shouldn't be so surprising, but because it kind of is the connecting tissue, literally, between this like ethereal world, which has, no, as I said in the past, like you can't hand me a triangle. Like triangles only exist in our minds, and the concept of a triangle only, there's no such thing as 3 0 dimensional points that you can hand to me, or how much does, you know, a point weigh? It's meaningless, right? So it's not physically embodied. But on the other hand, they also have to be very practical and bridge between sociology. Like, this book is as much about, you know, kind of human nature as, again, like, I don't choose how Amazon puts this in categories. One category, it was number one new release, and is Science for Kids, which I was tickled by having kids. But the other one was in, like, is in self-help success. And I was like, if you told me I'd write a self-help book along with such luminaries as James Altucher, I would have said, you're great. Like, but now I realize that, like, to whatever degree I've had success, is, you know, because I think I do care about the people I'm talking to. I am passionately curious about individual life and humanity as a whole, and why we make certain. So it's a book about humanity, and it is a self-help guide. You know, I'm coming out of the closet. I wrote a self-help book, James, and I'm damn proud of it.
No, it's very valuable, because again, I think seeing these people, like you say, the soft skills, seeing them talk about that and their struggles. Look, they had to raise funding for projects. They had to
convince peer reviewers.
Yeah, and look, and you also, sometimes it even boils down to, you have to name what you're doing. Like, here, the theory of relativity, that is a cool name. Like, you know, sometimes you have to be creative about how you're the entire presentation and branding of what you're doing, because you're also trying to show people this is important. You're showing your students, you're showing your peers, you're showing people, yep, like the Nobel Prize Committee, you're showing the public, so you can maybe write a book or mm-hmm, get in the news, or you have to be able to. And that's a salesman's job. And calling, yes, it a salesman sounds cheap, because you think of Death of a Salesman or whatever, but that's really what it is. It's a form of sales.
It's persuasion. And I think you've talked a lot about this on your show. And I think it's incredible. And even being a stand-up comic, right? You're there are all these skills. You said to me, you said, you know, on many occasions, not just to me, but you said, you know, there's no one skill. Stand-up comic.
Right.
Well, there's no one skill, physics. It's comprised of meta skills and pseudo skills. And yeah, we have this negative connotation with someone that can be persuasive as kind of like, you know, like oily, you know, whatever, snake oil salesman. And we also have these negative connotations, like Barry Barish writes in the foreword to Think Like a Nobel Prize Winner. He's like, curiosity killed the cat. Like if you ask somebody, like a kid, they'll think, like, curiosity, is that negative? And by the way, you know, scientists are prized for their childlike behaviors in a lot of ways. You know, we are very curious. We are very imaginative. We are very, you know, kind of productive in a certain playful sense. We are very inquisitive and and we, you know, have this unbridled enthusiasm. And I say, yes, it's true. We also have all the negative traits of kids too. There's no such thing as like a single-edged sword. I mean, that'd be great to make, but like we're jealous, we're petty, we don't like other people's success. We have Schadenfreude when they fail. We want them, you know, and so we have all these things because again, it's comprised of fixed games in the context of an infinite game. And very few people, I think, have that kind of awareness because look, on a daily basis, there's not a lot of room for introspection. Like I don't sit there thinking about, you know, the origin of the universe and the philosophical interpretation as much as I would like to. And I probably do it more than almost anybody I know because, you know, some would say I've got too much time on my hands. But the other perspective is like, we only have so much time until we die. Like we only have a finite amount of time. And these laureates are going to die someday. I'm going to die. You're going to, you know, unless one of my kids is working on the never dying pill. Hey, talk about branding. Isn't that good branding for the Nobel Prize in Chemistry and Biology?
It could happen soon. Who knows? I think there are some Nobel Prizes probably that have been, well, certainly the CRISPR is an anti-aging tool. So
Yeah. And I think that's incredibly exciting.
CRISPR, by the way, great branding for a tool that modifies DNA.
I know. I was like, yeah. Like, how would you like your genes, CRISPR? Yeah. Like that to be CRISPR, please. So, you know, my son also has another idea that the electron should have been named instead, because the positron, which is the antiparticle of the electron, as you know, the electron is Greek for amber, which is like, who the hell cares about that? But he said, why don't they call the electron the negatron?
Oh, yeah, I was like,
that's actually a much better name, yeah. Right? Yeah, so like this kid could be onto something. Anyway, that's
so,
my son.
So in addition to these soft skills, how do... The critical question, I guess, really is ultimately, how do they discover something that nobody else has ever discovered before? And by the way, this is not important just in physics. Again, you could do in any field, like in comedy, you really can't say a joke that's been said before, then you're stealing a joke or you're right. Just repeating yourself. You have to constantly come up with something that nobody has ever said, or you have to say something in a unique way that it's never been said that way before to really be great. And it's the same thing.
And it's different than...
Go ahead.
It's even harder, James, right? Because in like art, let's say there's Jackson Pollock or there's, you know, Dave Chappelle or you know, whoever, James Altucher, right? There's no right or wrong answer in arts, right? It's subjective. It's purely subjective. Like my toddler can make a painting as good as a Pollock and actually, you know, she has. But then I think about, you know, somebody else like would pay $100 million for that, right? Or digital art now, like with NFTs, which is really fascinating and so forth. Like literally anybody can do it. You can actually take a screen grab and make it into an NFT if you want. So the point being, there's no grade, but in physics, there is an ultimate grader and it's Mother Nature.
Right.
That, you know, she will tell you if you're right or wrong, and she will deny and crush your most basic hopes, which is why to see things like in sociology of science, things like string theory or inflation or other things persist for decades, even without experimental verification or validation, which used to be the sine qua non, you know, the essential essence of the scientific method, which I also have a chapter about in the book, just so people can look and think about, well, how can I apply the scientific method as a car salesman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or wherever Tulsa is? That being the case, you know, so I think that there is no one way, but there is there's no one path, but there's one destination. So it's easier in some ways and it's harder in other ways because you can't like work backwards from the punchline usually and like, oh, I know the audience is going to laugh. Like that's my grade, right? As a stand-up comedian, if the audience doesn't laugh, like it could be funny to you, but who cares, right? So you want to get a reaction that's in comport with where your expectations are. You're working backwards from that. If you knew this would make the audience laugh, like I have a punchline. I can't say it on the air because it's too dirty. I'll say it to you when we get off the phone. I think I've solved a major problem in stand-up comedy, but I'll tell you later.
The unifying theory, you know, of stand-up comedy and improv.
Exactly. That's right. I never came up with a theory of everything in physics, but so I had to go to comedy. But there's no right answer in the arts. So it's subjective, but in physics and science in general, there is. So that means that you know where you're going to end up if you're working on a problem.
So Brian, this is what I'm saying. So how, like for you, how would you even begin... Like, okay, you worked on bicep one, bicep two. Your goal was to actually build a device, a special telescope that could detect, you know, odd differences in the way gravitational waves were coming out of the cosmic background radiation. And then you would use this to prove inflation. So you stood on the shoulders of giants, or you looked over little people, or whatever you want to say, and you know that there's gravitational waves. You know that they must have been there since creation. You know that cosmic background radiation doesn't have any light through, and one of your Nobel Prize winners does allow for the has created the mechanisms for detecting gravitational waves. So what? But now you have to make some leap. What was the leap you made, and how do you think you made it?
Yeah, I think in that case, there comes along again with a double-edged sword, you know, blessing and a curse, which is that you have this kind of destination in sight, but you're also trying to get there. So there's get there-itis, and there's, you know, sunk cost bias, but there's also confirmation bias that, like, when you see things that comport with the thing you're trying to pursue, you're going to be more likely to accept those and more likely to exclude disconfirming signs that you might be wrong, like dust could have been responsible for the signal that you were seeking. And so you'll go to great lengths to kind of accentuate the pathways that conform to the expected result.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers, and he waited a little too long, and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles.
immediately after you post your job. ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
What struck your curiosity in the first place? Why did nobody else ever in history do what you were proposing to do? Like, how did you become the first one to do this? Now, part of it is because the state of technology evolves, and so now you're allowed to do this. But where did your curiosity come from that allowed you to discover something new? Again, it's easy to solve old equations, but you're trying to solve a new problem that you've discovered or that you thought about. So how did you come with that initial insight?
So in my context, you know, I think it had a bunch to do with my own, again, maybe grandiose desire to understand, you know, the biggest possible mysteries in you know, the human mind is capable of comprehending, while I still had that, you know, product of knowledge rising up and forgetting falling down. And it happened to coincide with a period of great technological advances and also great, you know, questions. I always say, you know, a great question is one that doesn't, you know, or a great answer, you know, is not one that answers all the questions. It may inspire new questions. And at that time, there were kind of results that were discovered in particular by my late great, you know, postdoctoral mentor, Andrew Lang, who tragically committed suicide, as I describe in losing the Nobel Prize, and grappling with that. But also, you know, he kind of provided this inspiration that while he discovered a particular pattern in this radiation, nobody knew how that pattern got established in the initial conditions of the early universe. And so I said, well, he solved this great paradox describing how the universe looks today, but is there a reason why the universe looks this the way that it does? And there were theorists that had conjectured that, yes, this mechanism called inflation would produce gravitational waves, but none of them really kind of made the connection that now we can do it and we don't need this enormous telescope that costs billions of dollars. You could do it on the cheap for a few million dollars, which is what we attempted to do. And for a while, we're successfully perceived to have done so. I want to do this. I want to understand, was there a Big Bang? Was the universe created as, I mean, again, I've talked about this before on the show. I'm not embarrassed by it, but to say that I wanted to win a Nobel Prize to outdo my scientific father and do one him better, just like, you know, kids want to win the Super Bowl. Their parents are, you know, great football players or whatever. So that was one motivation. But the other one was I wanted to basically falsify, you know, or approve the description in Genesis 1:1, you know, that there was a creation of the universe.
Okay, and there's a problem, which is that, you know, telescopes and basically any visual instrument depends on light, but light was not getting through the cosmic background radiation. The cosmic background radiation was created 300,000 years after the creation of the universe, or after the universe, the Big Bang happened, or yeah, whatever. So there's a problem. Mm-hmm. That the problem is, yeah, there's no physical way to use a normal device like a telescope to see what happened before the cosmic background radiation. And so your insight, standing on the shoulders of giants, was that, hey, not only can perhaps gravitational waves get through the cosmic background radiation, but here's how I could build a device that
detects those so far away.
That's right. And looking back, you know, through, again, the lens of history, I do see a commonality, and might be the only one, with these laureates, is that they were all inspired by someone. I call it like a father figure, you know, or mentor or whatever in the book. You know, some of them might have been women, I don't know, but they talk about, and quite literally, they talk about their fathers in many cases. And sometimes it's bittersweet because they win it so late in life, most of them, not Adam Rees, who's my age. He won it and his father inspired him to get it.
He won it when he was 41.
Yeah, he was the youngest, one of the youngest laureates in history. He's still, he's a good friend. I talked to him this morning, you know, send him a copy of the new book. You know, he's convinced I'm stalking him because the second book that has him in it. And then having, you know, people, but older laureates like, you know, Barry and Ray Weiss are in their late 80s or, you know, in their 80s. They don't have their parents around to be there when they want it at in such a late age. So a lot of them were inspired. I was inspired, you know, again, Andrew Lang was like a father figure to me, and the man who committed suicide, whose wife later went on to win the Nobel, or his ex-wife went on to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry.
But this is very interesting. Someone who not just inspires you, but is almost like plays a role of some sort of father figure. And by the way, it's no accident that
like
a lot of Nobel Prize winners throughout history have been orphans. They lost their fathers young. So maybe their first professors was the first time they experienced as an adult that kind of fatherly presence. And you're trying to, just like you're trying, like you mentioned, like, just like you're trying to prove something to your father, you're going beyond just normal inspiration and intuition. You're trying to take something they couldn't solve, or they hit a plateau,
yes,
and you're trying to go beyond them like a son does. And
in fact, I think
that's I think that should be respected. I wonder if that could even be, you know, cultivate a feeling of childhood with your mentors to cultivate that kind of curiosity. That's what got you to basically not only be curious, but have the soft skills to raise the millions of dollars required to build your telescope in Antarctica, of all places. So
yeah, and I look at like the two, you know, most famous Nobel Prize winning physicists of the 20th century, Albert Einstein and Richard Feynman. So Einstein was, you know, inspired in many occasions to ask questions, but he also didn't ask questions of his father. And he actually credits, you know, the theory of relativity to not asking questions as a kid, but only as an adult when he had the swagger and the toolkit. In other words, if he had asked his dad at age, you know, 7, what happens if I travel along a light beam and look at myself in a mirror, you know, do I see anything? He said his father would have just given him the answer that, you know, oh, you see yourself or you don't see yourself, thus squelching the curiosity that would then have deprived humanity, at least for some time. Because again, unlike art, physics and art are not the same. They have a lot of commonalities, and I talk about them in the book, how they are similar. You know, there's no one right answer in art. There's no, there is a right answer in physics as judged by nature. But in art, if nobody came up with the theory of relativity, if Einstein didn't come up with the theory of relativity, some other person would. In fact, you know, there are many people hot on the trail.
Yeah, it's one of those parallel discoveries. There were several scientists, right, working on the same thing.
Yeah, but if Michelangelo didn't, you know, paint the Mona Lisa, or Leonardo, who painted the Mona Lisa? Now I'm getting
Da Vinci.
Da Vinci. So nobody would have painted it, right? So nobody would have painted it. They would have painted other pictures of, but it wouldn't have that mercurial, magical spell, right? So there's a benefit to art too. Just like, you know, if you don't make some joke that only you could make, nobody's ever going to make that particular joke.
That's true. But like something like cubism impressionist art or pop art, things like this probably would have.
Styles of art, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Styles of art, sure. And who knows? Now artificial art is now coming online, right? So Einstein said that he credited not asking his dad on one hand for the answer because it would have stunted his own intellectual growth. And then Feynman talks about after he won the Nobel Prize, his dad said to him, he was very proud of him, and they were very close. And he said, you know, son, I always had this question I was too embarrassed to ask you, but now you won the Nobel Prize, I'm going to ask you. When an electron transitions in an atom from a high energy state to a low energy state, it emits a photon, as you showed in quantum electrodynamics, right? And he said, right, my father. And then the father said, well, was the photon like stored inside the electron, like a little battery? And Feynman said, I don't know. And he said, I never saw such a look of disappointment and depression as I did on that particular day. Like, he let his dad down, even though he had a Nobel Prize. So I think it's there is something to it. And of course, we don't mean only men can be mentors. Let's be obvious about it. Some of my teachers, but some Svengali, some Obi-Wan, and it's part of the hero's journey, right? Because you go through this abstraction where nobody knows where they're going to come out. They don't even know if an answer exists. I always say, you know, graduate school to my students, it's not like undergraduate school, but harder. You know, the tests are a little harder. There's more advanced, you know, there's more decimal places. No. You don't even know if there is an answer.
Right.
Like undergraduate, somebody's going to get it right, but you're not, maybe. I'm not.
Again, it's the difference between knowledge and discovery. So up until graduate school, you're accumulating knowledge. This is the basic toolkit to basically solve these problems. But then in graduate school, you've got to discover something. You can't just have more knowledge.
Right. It can't just be some incremental polishing of some other theory or so, something fundamentally new that did not exist until you came on the planet to do it. So I think those are exciting and exhilarating aspects of being a scientist. And it kind of, you know, does take away some of the mundanity of a lot of it is like, you know, you asked earlier, do people still want to do this? And I'm looking at, you know, my students now saying, well, maybe I don't want to do this. So I wanted to ask, you know, before my students leave and go work for Google or Apple, or, you know, a lot of them are just like, I don't want your life anymore. And it's just so kind of bemusing in a certain sense, because, you know, this is all I wanted to do. And I never thought I could do it because I never thought I was good enough, whatever. I thought there was, you know, there are people much better than I am. I get to work with them every day. But to have, you know, kind of this notion that here I am, like, am I depressed because I didn't win the Nobel Prize? No, and not at all. And if I did win the Nobel Prize, how would things change? And I think,
well, you wouldn't be agreeing to go on the James Altucher Show podcast, that's for sure.
You mean inviting myself to come on the James Altucher
Show? No, you have an open invitation, so.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it means a lot to me. This is like one of my, I've started like to maximize my happiness. You know, one of the things that respected happiness consultants that you've had on your show recommend is like write down like things that you're looking forward to every day. And so like, this is my highlight of the week, is talking with you. It's so much
we
fun.
We always look forward to it here. And I want to, this idea that these people, these physicists who are at the highest level discovered something new and had this very deep curiosity. I think it is a hard thing to kind of decode the DNA of this. But I wrote down some other quotes from your book. One was diversify your pursuits, which is, you know, referred to in a lot of different books. But I think, you know, it's the idea that, yes, you might be making discoveries about black holes, but it doesn't mean you can't be obsessed with drawing. And maybe inspiration and ideas you get from understanding the nuances of another field will give you curiosity and specific nuances that no one ever has had before in physics. So I like that, diversify your pursuits. We talked about ask if there's a better way.
I think the fun aspect is something that's overlooked, you know, because it is like, look, there always be aspects of a career that are boring, mundane, frustrating. So how do you get through that? I don't think passion will get you through that. I kind of make the analogy, you know, passion's kind of like willpower. Like, it's great to have willpower, you know, so I won't eat this donut. But it's better to have like a system in play. You've had Jocko on. He doesn't even respond to my emails. Like, this guy, you know, is my neighbor here in San Diego. We have the same birthday, I think the actual birthday. And he won't respond. But Jocko, if you're listening out there, I want to have you on the show because I want to talk about scientific warfare and how science and astronomy in particular has been used in warfare.
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, by the way, wrote a book about...
I had a book about that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and there's aspects that I think we could go really deep on. But anyway, he talks about, like, you know, discipline, etc. But, like, there's something that even trumps both of those, and I think it's, like, it's like God, you know, like my kids won't eat, you know, that delicious, you know, Cuban sandwich that you used to get in Florida or whatever, because it has pork in it and we keep kosher. Right. So if you look at it from that, like, there's no system of willpower. Like, it's not even a temptation. Like, I've never gone down and said, you know, I really like to have that shrimp or that oyster. Like, it doesn't appeal to me at all. And you know, you could say I'm brainwashed or, you know, whatever. I don't think that happens to be the case. I think actually putting the system in place so that you don't have to think is actually incredibly discipline, example of incredible discipline.
Accumulating small ways of accumulating energy, whether it's wearing the same outfit every day or delegating
decision
some of your,
fatigue avoidance. You want to avoid the
accumulating small advantages and energy. I'm writing these down.
Yeah, I think putting those systems in place so that you can be prepared when inspiration does strike. But if you wait for inspiration and curiosity, I think that our passion rather, like that is a diminishing resource. That's a resource that gets used up. It's a wasting asset, you know, again, to use the economic analogy. And I think, you know, the ultimate goal of the book, again, is really one to not like teach you, like Feynman said a lot of things about the Nobel Prize that it's kind of like Einstein. He always talked about religion so ambiguously. You couldn't tell what he believed, if he didn't believe. Some say he did believe. But anyway, you can use their quotes to say anything. But on one occasion, you know, Feynman would say things like, if you can't explain it to your grandmother, then you don't understand it. And then when he won the Nobel Prize, he said, if I could explain to you what I won the Nobel Prize for, it wouldn't be worth a Nobel Prize. But on the same token, you have to live in that dichotomy. Again, a Jockoism, right? So the dichotomy of leadership.
I think though the methods might be unexplainable because that's the toolkit that you've spent years building. But
yes,
but I agree that and in your book, you say seek elegance, like things are often simpler than they seem. Like you have to be able to, it's an important part of accumulating knowledge and wisdom to be able to also teach things in a simple way so that others can understand it. You need to be the giant that other people stand on. Your shoulders need to be the shoulders of that giant. And the only way you could do that, the only way you could be a giant in your industry is if you can explain things simply. So that's like a criteria of being a great thinker.
Right. And the most elegant way to describe something is to describe it simply. I mean, and I do this, actually, I've done this as a parent for some time, not because I really think like my kids can understand trigonometry at age 8 or whatever, but like, what's the first level of acquiring mastery of something? You know, Cialdini spoke about that with you. It's like, you have to learn the lexicon. You have to learn the vocabulary. What are the tools of the trade? Like, if you don't know how a pawn moves, like, you're not going to learn. But you can learn basic things. Like, you might not know how, like, some opening is supposed to unfold or some ending game is supposed to unfold as a kid. But, like, the first step is to understand the lexicon and the vocabulary. So what's the first step of that? And deconstructing those skills is, like, just hearing the words. So, like, every night as I put my kids to sleep, I talk about, you know, the Einstein equation. No, I don't do that. But I do talk about, like, at an early age, just expose your kids to simple things. Like, even I've mentioned in the past, and this is, like, our next Side Hustle Friday, has to be the number one problem that I'm trying to solve is, like, I want to get in on some of that sweet, sweet telescope scratch, James. So every time I'm asked, like, what's the most simple thing to get my kid interested in STEM and science, technology, engineering, and math, it's get them a $50 telescope and just point it at anything besides the sun, James. This is a doctor of astronomy speaking very carefully. Don't point it at the sun. Don't point it at your neighbor. Point it at anything in the sky, and you will be blown away. And you will, in fact, James, not only be able to make a scientific discovery yourself, but you'll have the exact same experience emotionally, viscerally, physically, as Galileo did, in a way completely unlike, say, the Large Hadron Collider. When they discovered the Higgs boson, like, you can't buy a Higgs boson, you know, a LHC accelerator and just go to work. And, oh, that's how they felt when they discovered it. Look, it takes years. It takes billions of dollars. But a telescope, James, you will be connected emotionally to Galileo Galilei. And because you'll replicate exactly what he felt. What the hell does the moon have those stupid craters? Oh, my God. It's like the Earth. It has mountains. It has lava.
Right, because here's the thing. I think a telescope leads naturally to questions. Like, you see something in the sky and you ask, what is that? And
yes.
So, and again, it's not just looking at the
telescope. Other people invented the telescope, as you know. Other people invented the telescope, not Galileo. This guy, Hans Lippershey, and they even think some guy looked at the moon a day before Galileo in England, but he never wrote it up because he was like, whatever. But Galileo improved upon it. He asked questions. He used discipline. He used a systematic approach to discovery that I think is wonderful. So I want to get a telescope company. I've talked to James Quandrell, our friend James, the other James in my life I love. And I'm just, how do I get the Keating brand telescope?
Because that's a great idea.
I'm missing out on $50 each
biceps,
time, right?
Keating brand bicep X.
Discovery, yeah, the bicep.
But it's interesting though, because you're right, like that, a telescope is literally a view into the unknown. And and again, you're not going to benefit, your curiosity is not going to grow if you just look at the telescope and say, that's beautiful. Everything I'm seeing is beautiful.
Yeah.
Your curiosity will grow if you say, what is that? And so you have to discover now what that is. Or if you say, I wish I could see that better. And you discover how telescopes work and how you can make it better. It doesn't have to be something that's new to the planet, just new to you. You're practicing that discovery muscle.
And again, you get that visceral feel. Like, imagine if you could like look at Jupiter and then you could actually like feel the temperature of Jupiter. Like, you can't do that. But actually with the discovery, which is even more significant than knowing the physical properties, oh, it's made of methane and ammonia. No, you actually replicate the thrill of discovery as done in the first time in human history. What are those little tiny bright stars next to Jupiter at night after night? And then maybe become systematic about it. You get a little notebook. Like, I still have my 12-year-old notebook where I talk about, you know, all the girls that I hope to ask out and et cetera. But I also had in there some sketches of, you know, the Orion Nebula. James, I didn't know it. I was doing exactly what Galileo did. And he was doing, you know, what just came naturally to him. So like maybe the book could have been, you know, Think Like Galileo. But I do feel that there is, you know, people make it out to be so hard. Like, I you know, how do I get my kids interested in STEM, or how do I get them to be like spend less time on the internet? And like there's so many just simple answers, but I guess people don't want to hear them, or maybe they're scared and intimidated. Maybe perhaps they feel like, well, these kids are going to know more than me and I'll look stupid. And that's another thing, like humility of these laureates. Like, one of them told me, I wish I was doing what you're doing. Like, in other words, like, I wish I was young. I wish I could do like young. I'm not that young, but
wish I was so good looking.
That's right, as you. So I feel like, you know, well, it's been an amazing thing for me to learn about. As you know, like, I started this project because I wanted to kind of replicate, capture the fire, bottle the magic of Think Like a Billionaire, and replicate that and hopefully go down future roads with you in different ways. But, you know, I've kind of like, you know, people are asking me, well, who's the publisher? And but not really, like, they're not like, who's the public? They're like, how did you get this published? And I'm like, well, you know, I have connections with, you know, James, and connected me to editors and so forth. And, you know, it's all
you
my
did
material
a very
or
choose
my
yourself or skip the line kind of strategy, which is also a process of discovery. Like, it used to be that everyone thought they needed to use a mainstream publisher, but you could ask the question, well, what if I do it a better way? Like, or is there a better way to do this?
I asked my friend, Stefan Alexander, who I hope is coming on the James Altucher show. He's written two, you know, best-selling books, one called The Jazz of Physics. And he's a cosmologist at Brown University, my alma mater, my oldest friends. And his new book is called Fear of a Black Universe.
Oh,
and it has an endorsement.
I've seen that. I saw it on the bookshelf.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully you'll get him on the show.
Yeah,
I've connected him to Jay, and he's amazing. He's a professional jazz musician, a sprinter, and he's a cosmologist. And he wrote, and as he got a blurb, I got a blurb from you. He got a blurb from Chuck D of Public Enemy. And, you know,
yeah, because Fear of a Black Planet was their biggest hit.
Exactly. And it's not about like, oh, you know, being a black, it's not really about that at all. It's more about like setting, like hawking, you know, kind of redux with A Brief History of Time. It's now like A Brief History of the Future. But when I look at him, I was talking to him last night, cause we're just, you know, he's like my oldest friend. And I'm like, Steph, you know, how many more books, like, what's your ideal day? And I want to ask you, James, in the last couple of minutes, what's your idea? What does your calendar look like in 2025? You know, like, what are you doing? And I asked him, like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm writing books and I'm getting up and I'm with my students and maybe hanging out with my bros and with my woman. And I was like, that sounds great. But like, how many books can you write? And he said, I think I got 3 books left in me. And I said, well, what would it look like? You know, Tim Ferriss is the other person who inspired me to write this book. Like, he asked these questions, like, what would it look like if it was easy? And I'm like, this is kind of easy. Like, I had these brilliant intellects on my show. Yeah, I had to do a lot of research. I had to have them on. I had Jay to engineer it. I had to find, you know, you to inspire me. But ultimately, you know, like, it was much easier than my first book, which I got paid below minimum wage to write, you know, from the advance. I got no advance on this book, but I think it's superior because it's timely. It's going to be actionable. I want this in the hands of your listeners. That's why I made it 99 cents for the electronic version. I don't care about making millions. I want to sell millions of copies, or not millions, but I don't care about being a bestseller. I think that's futile. But I do want it to get into the hands of people, as I wish this book existed when I was X age, whatever X could be. But I want to ask you, you know, now that there are so many easy ways to do things and to get actionable stuff out into the public, like, if you had the coronavirus cure but you didn't have it until 2035, great, but you know, we needed it in 2021, right? So, or some of us would take it, but anyway, the thing I want to ask you is, yeah, what is your count, what does it look like, what do you want to do, what is still left within you to be unlocked or to be unleashed on the world? Like, what does your calendar look like in 2025? What's an ideal
day? I have no idea, because I will say that every time I have ever thought what my calendar would be or should be in the coming year, it ended up being completely different. I always do, I don't like doing what I don't love doing. So I always try to do, be as close as possible to do things that don't require me to manifest the energy of love for it. Like I should have that. So like, for instance, when I started doing stand-up comedy, I wanted to write a novel that year. I ended up doing for the next 6 years comedy. And so I don't know, but I do, right now I am interested in this, in for instance, this podcast, like, we were asking, like, how do these great high achievers, how do they think of these amazing new discoveries? How are they curious in the ways they are? Like, breaking that down. I do think adults, people are at our advanced age, can start from scratch in a field and improve and be great and you know, make serious accomplishments in it. And that's what I'm interested in now, is finding different ways into that question. And, you know, podcasts like this certainly help. Like, these podcasts are for me, and I'm glad that people are listening to them. But I wrote these notes down for myself.
Yeah. No, I'm glad. I'm so glad. Again, I have to give what we say in Hebrew, hakara satov. The essence of the word Judaism, you know, comes from the Hebrew word gratitude, yehoda. And I think that's what defines somebody who has a certain positive relationship and with the universe, if you like. And I want to express gratitude to you for inspiring me to write this book. And hopefully we can continue on this journey together in different ways that the audience will find out about. But now I want to get off, because I want to tell you my dirty joke off the air so that I don't sully the minds of any of our listeners.
Well, Brian Keating, author of Into the Impossible, Think Like a Nobel Prize Winner. And you've interviewed all these Nobel Prize winners and really broke it down. And I challenge the readers to read this book and tell me some of the DNA of curiosity that you find in this excellent book. So, because I want to know. Oh, I should say the subtitle. There's only like two subtitles. So the title is Into the Impossible, Think Like a Nobel Prize Winner. And the subtitle is Lessons from Laureates to Stoke Curiosity, Spur Collaboration, and Ignite Imagination in Your Life and Career. And
with a foreword by
James, a total imposter in this community, James Altucher, alongside Nobel Prize winner Barry Barish.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as close as you'll get. Maybe. We still have to work on our theory of everything. Well, James, I want to thank you. And I want to offer your listeners to go to my website, briankeating.com. I've got some bonus material. It's basically all there. It's all free. You don't have to buy the book, but we did make it 99 cents so people would get it. And hopefully people can really appreciate it. I'd love to hear from people, join my mailing list. And otherwise, look forward to many adventures, including a new audiobook, first time in history, with your former guest, Carlo Rovelli, and yours truly, reading the words of Galileo Galilei in the dialogue.
Excellent. I look forward to that. So, all right, Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Doors take us to summers away or winter adventures and afternoon getaways. Your dedicated Fidelity advisor can help you open those doors by working with you on a comprehensive plan to help you reach your wealth's full potential. Because doors were meant to be opened. Visit fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.